Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Bacon Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we'll be speaking with Carissa Arrett of Big Brothers Big Sisters of Northern New Mexico. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Gregory Heltman. He is founder and general director of the Santa Fe Symphony and Chorus, which opens this year on Sunday, the 9th of October. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be here again.
It's great to have you. Now, we are lucky to have our own symphony, and making a symphony work is something maybe we can talk about a little later, but that's no joke in this economy and in this modern world.
It's a challenge for all of the performing arts. Actually, there was a recent survey analysis done by the National Endowment for the Arts and the League of American Orchestras looking at the participation rates across the board from commercial theater to nonprofit jazz, opera, ballet, even to professional sports, and participation has gone down by the general audience. And I submit, especially in the last 10 years, it's because this idea everything has to be convenient. And how much more convenient is it to have your big screen TV hooked up to your computer and download the Berlin Philharmonic with Dudamel conducting than getting out of your pajamas, getting in your car, going to the concert hall or to the theater and have to park and all those kind of hassles? And it's rather a sad commentary in society that live experience, it has been exchanged for the convenience. I call it, if you will, the McDonaldization of our society. So it's something we have to purposefully address to make that concert experience, that live concert experience, so valuable that people do want to make the effort.
What is the, I mean, I feel it, but you tell me from your point of view what the magic of live concert music is all about.
There is the immediacy of being able to see people's expressions and not having your view determined by a director. So if you're looking at a broadcast or something over the internet, there has been a director who has said to the camera people, okay, at this moment you're going to go into the oboe player or you're going to go into the main dancer. And in the audience, if it's live, you might decide, I wonder what that fourth bass player is doing. What is that third trumpet player doing in the back? In the meantime, the main interest from a producer standpoint or director standpoint may in fact be what's happening with the conductor or with the violins.
And so on some level, it's so personal and even a little bit arbitrary what that producer chooses.
Exactly. And so the live performance gives you a chance for an immediacy and intimacy. And it's well rehearsed, no question about that, but there's not a second chance. If something goes really wonderfully well, fabulous. You would capture that on a broadcast. But if something goes a little askance, they can come back after the live performance and fix it. And all the major orchestras do that.
Right.
So that's kind of the excitement. You know, people like to say performers need to take chances. But there's no value in taking chances unless there's someone to sort of to share the excitement, the attempt, if you will.
And when you're watching a live performance, whatever kind of music it is, you always get, I mean, as an audience member, you always get fixated on somebody.
Exactly. I do, too. I do, too. And that's a lot of the fun of it.
Yeah. So how do you put together a season which is creative, challenging, lovable, ticket selling, all those things?
Well, if I knew exactly the proper equation for achieving all those things you mentioned, you know, we'd be rolling in dough.
Yeah, right.
But in fact, the Santa Fe Symphony Orchestra and Chorus, the symphony as we're calling it these days, is a cooperative organization, which means we have musicians who serve on the board of directors with the full rights and responsibility as non-musicians. It's a rather unique organization. I, as executive director, perform in the orchestra, and the musicians select the music and the music director, in fact. And so what happens in our process, our musician committee comprises 7 players from the orchestra, plus Stephen Smith, our music director-conductor, serves on the programming committee, plus our choral director, plus 2 members from the board who have a great deal of interest in classical music. And we sit down and we say, what do we like to play this year? And then we start talking about, well, we think that piece is going to sell. One of our program committee members is an aficionado of Charles Ives. And I'm sitting there thinking, Charles Ives, great music, interesting American composer. What do we can combine it with that is going to help bring people into the audience? And this day and age, as you mentioned earlier, is very important that we play music that has a broad appeal.
Right.
And that goes from the Baroque to Copland to Gershwin to the Romantics, Tchaikovsky, that sort of thing, Richard Strauss, Respighi.
So for the opening day, which is Sunday, the 9th of October, at 4 in the afternoon, which is when the symphonies are, what a nice time of day.
It's been very successful for us. We used to perform at 3, and then people were saying, you know, I'm out hiking, and it's somehow an hour later would make a big difference to me. So we went to 4, and it's been wonderful for us.
And especially as the days grow shorter and daylight savings time ends and all of that, it's starting almost to be evening by that time, but not quite.
And those folks who have difficulty seeing at night to drive really appreciate the 4 o'clock time. It's late enough in the afternoon, but not so late that they have to be driving in pitch black nighttime.
So tell us about the program for that day.
We're going to begin our 28th season with a season spectacular, and that name was chosen on purpose because the Richard Strauss Don Juan was one of the first tone poems that he wrote when he was 23, 24 years old, and it's very lush, very romantic, very powerful. And then we follow that with Liszt Totentanz, which is a concerto for piano and orchestra. I first heard the Liszt Totentanz with Andre Watts when I was performing in the Stockton Symphony, Stockton, California. I was going to the University of the Pacific Conservatory of Music and playing in the orchestra. And I'll never forget it. It's just a phenomenal, virtuosic piece, powerful. Liszt, you know, was the rock star of his day. And then we also will present Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 23 with an up-and-coming piano rock star, if you will. His name is Adam Golka, and he was the 2008 Gilmour Prize winner, and in 2011 won the American Pianist Association Prize, which is a two-year fellowship, and as a result, the prize is worth some $70,000, $80,000, including a recording contract and plus numerous appearances around the country.
And so he's crazy awesome.
He's crazy awesome. He's like 22.
Really?
Yeah, he's very... He's just a kid.
Yeah, I've seen these kids play.
It's phenomenal. It's phenomenal. And in fact, Adam had been in Santa Fe now about 3 years ago.
Oh, okay.
So it'll be great for him to be back in Santa Fe. And we conclude the afternoon with a spectacular piece of music, Respighi's Pines of Rome, which many folks may recognize from the Fantasia 2000, the Disney production, which had the flying whales in it, and the Chicago Symphony, by the way.
Let's hear clips from a couple of those. Do you want to talk about the Richard Strauss?
Sure. The Don Juan is a piece of music based generally on this idea of the Lothario Don Juan. Of course, there was Mozart's Don Giovanni, which based on the same idea about
major womanizer who leaves everybody in ruins.
Right, and at the end of the day, gets his comeuppance. And in Richard Strauss's version, his comeuppance is his realization that he has never found true love, and perhaps it's too late. So that is what he really realizes he's been longing for through all this time. And Strauss has come up with a wonderfully powerful theme that we will hear in this little excerpt that we'll be enjoying. And so it's a virtuosic piece for orchestra. The last Richard Strauss that we performed of this size was the Death and Transfiguration. So it's great to revisit this repertoire.
Let's listen to just a little clip from Don Juan by Strauss.
Thank you.
And that was an excerpt of Don Juan by Richard Strauss. Sorry, I have a German mother. I have to say everything with German accent.
That's fabulous. I love it.
No, it's good. Gregory Heltman is the founder and general director of the Santa Fe Symphony and Chorus. And so that's one of the pieces that's going to be played on the 9th of October. Now, the other that we want to play a little excerpt of, actually the first movement of, which is very short, is The Pines of Rome by Respighi. Tell us about that piece.
Respighi was a romantic nationalist, and much in the same vein as Ravel and Debussy, or even Tchaikovsky, Rimsky-Korsakov, and he was inspired by the landmarks of his home. So we have these visions of the pines of Rome. This first movement are the pines of the Via Borghese, the park around that beautiful, beautiful structure, and brings to mind children playing in the park, couples walking through the park, just having a wonderful joy recreating in this beautiful setting. Also, the next movement from the Pines of Rome is entitled The Pines Near the Catacomb. And what Respighi does is create very quiet, mysterious music, not necessarily scary music. It doesn't evoke the idea of the Dies Irae of Verdi's Requiem, for example, or the Symphony Fantastique of Berlioz, but it does give you this sense of reverence of walking in the catacombs with the bones of the martyrs that are stacked from centuries before. The third movement is the Pines of the Janiculum, and the Janiculum, the Roman legion returning triumphant to Rome, and the music starts very quietly with a repetitive sort of march, fanfare-like music that gets louder and louder and ends up very, very excitingly with offstage brass, which at the Lenzig will have being performed from the catwalk above the stage.
Really?
And we have this organ, although it's an electronic organ, it's a digital pipe organ sound. It's just an explosion of music and sound. It's an automatic standing ovation because it's so exciting. And again, referencing the Fantasia 2000, I recall when we used to watch this with my son in his early elementary school days, of the incredible animation that the Disney artist had come up with, these whales that triumphant. It's just great.
I mean, I've never seen either of the Fantasias, the one from, what was it, the 60s, and then Fantasia 2000. I mean, for you as a symphony director and a lifelong classical musician, are they adding to the music, detracting from it? I mean, how do you feel about these Disney Fantasia films?
Well, the original Fantasia in 1941 was cutting edge.
Oh, it was that long ago?
It was that long ago. It was cutting edge. It was the first multi-plane animation. It was the first that combined animation and drawings with actual photography. It was the first film that had surround sound, full stereo. And so Disney had intended this to be a performance piece. It wasn't a cartoon in the sense of Mickey Mouse or in the sense of Cinderella or any of these other early cartoons that he had made, full-length animated films. It was to be a concert piece, and so he had Leopold Stokowski, the Philadelphia Orchestra performing major works of the symphonic repertoire, and he had at these special theaters, which had to be particularly equipped to have the stereo sound, the stereo surround sound, he had special program books printed. It was quite a remarkable production, and of course with the onset of World War II, it lost a lot of money and nearly ruined him. And he was very disappointed at the rather cool reception that this got. But over the years, it really became an icon of the animation arts and what could be done. And so in 2000, Roy Disney, I think was his nephew, released the next edition, because the intent of Walt Disney was to have Fantasia be an every decade sort of thing with different musical thematic material. And what was very particular about the Fantasia 2000 is not only the selection of music, but none of it is computer generated.
Interesting.
It's all old-fashioned style.
Cell animation.
Spectacular. So, long story short, I found it to be inspiring. I found it when I was teaching elementary music, vocal general music, that it was very helpful in getting kids engaged with classical music.
Right.
Now, granted, I had to finesse the whole thing with the Night on Bald Mountain, because it has these gargoyles flying in the scene that are topless. And they're female in form.
Yeah, well.
But, you know, I said...
They all have mothers.
Right. Well, basically, there was a video glitch when that came along. The music kept playing. I said, oh, I don't know what happened to the video. And I knew exactly when to pull it off. At any rate, I think it's as an introduction to the uninitiated in this very visual society in which we live now, I think it can be a very valuable tool.
For children and adults alike.
Exactly.
We're talking to Gregory Heltman of the Santa Fe Symphony and Chorus. So let's hear, back to the Villa Borghese, the Respighi Pines of Rome. Let's hear that first movement.
Great, super.
Okay. Just heard the first movement of Respighi's The Pines of Rome, the entirety of which will be played on Sunday the 9th of October, the grand opening spectacular of the Santa Fe Symphony and Chorus. We're talking to Gregory Heltman. So you are a musician yourself. What do you play?
I play trumpet in the orchestra.
And do you still play? So you're an active musician.
Yes. So every day after I take Mark to school, and my wife, Elaine, who's our principal oboist, goes to work. Then I have time alone in the house, and that's when I get my practicing in. Because at nighttime, Elaine comes home. We're helping Mark with his homework, of course. And she's making reeds for the oboe. So she pretty much monopolizes the music room for the 2 hours that she needs, 2 or 3 hours a night.
And so you're able to keep that up to be an active musician and run the symphony.
It is a challenge, but I think it's really important. It provides this sense of accessibility to my colleagues. There's not many layers of bureaucracy between an issue they may have, if you will, on the shop floor and the executive running the organization, and that is in keeping with this whole collaborative, cooperative process that we have. The other members of the steering committee, who in many ways I work for, are also there at these rehearsals. And at the end of the day, the concerts are the shining tip of the iceberg. And without being participating in that, I think it would be very difficult for me just to be part of the underwater part of the iceberg making that happen.
Yeah. So let's talk about the conductor of the orchestra. That's, of course, a huge, huge job of keeping everything together.
Stephen Smith is our music director, conductor. And he comes from an orchestral player background. He was a violinist, was the concertmaster of the Grand Rapids Symphony many, many years ago, and then decided to become a conductor and studied conducting at the Cleveland Institute of Music, and was also, before the Santa Fe Symphony, was the assistant conductor of the Cleveland Orchestra. And so he brings this great experience of working with a major orchestra in this country, as well as the experience of being, if you will, in the trenches. And I think that's very important for his successful collaboration in this organization. And I use that very specifically in that the musicians of the symphony, now 13 years ago, we had several candidates. It was the musicians who voted to hire Stephen. It was the musicians who 2 years ago voted to renew Stephen's contract. And that's only contingent upon the board's ability to come to arrive to a suitable contract that's affordable from both parties. And that's really a very unique situation. Most music directors and conductors are selected by a committee that essentially comprises board members, wealthy donors, and oftentimes that person is imposed upon the ensemble. Well, that does not make a lot of sense, because a conductor, imagine moving a baton in rhythm, does not make music. That baton moving through the air may make sound, but doesn't make music without the collaboration and buy-in of 85 players in front of him or her.
It's truly an artist-run organization,
which is
unusual for a symphony.
We're following a model that is not unusual in Europe. The Vienna Philharmonic, since I think 1849, is a musician-run organization. They have a principal conductor, but they don't have a music director in the American sense of the term, of Toscanini, who we just heard perform the Pines of Rome, which was very dictatorial, very, very challenging to perform in that situation.
We'll have to have Stephen on sometime. I don't think I've ever had him on the air, but the thing that I so admire, and I guess is I find baffling about conductors, is how they can hear all the instruments at the same time.
Well, it's as any other art form, and that is you train for it, and I think it's a matter of having one's mind be able to focus at the most important melodic line or harmonic line in a given moment within the broader context or texture.
We don't have time to talk, of course, about every single concert that you're playing this season, but people can go to the website and find out for themselves or get on the mailing list and
yes,
all sorts of things. And you've got, but they're always Sundays. They're always at 4 p.m.
That's correct.
And there's one in the series called Voyages of Discovery. This year it's called Bach on the Brain, and that is a collaboration with the Santa Fe Institute, and we don't want to talk too much about that right now, because we're going to try to get somebody
right
from the Institute to talk about the relationship between Bach, the brain, and this concert. But there's another piece of music that we have on deck, Sibelius.
Sibelius. Music is so evocative of the fjords of Norway, of Northern Europe. Anything that we can think about that comes to mind, the sea, the expanse, the loneliness, Sibelius is able to capture in his music. And his Symphony No. 2 is incredibly triumphant. It's very demanding. We haven't played it now since our old days at the Sweeney Center back in the late 90s. And so it's great to revisit this wonderful selection of music. He is such a wonderful writer, idiomatically, for every instrument he knows, the capabilities, the potentialities of every section. And so his music, while 20th century music, is certainly romantic and nationalistic in its sound. It's very, very accessible.
What does it mean for music to be nationalistic?
Well, I think one of the most easy examples to point to is Aaron Copland. So Aaron Copland took fiddle tunes, Appalachian fiddle tunes, and set them to an orchestra, most notably Appalachian Spring, for example. He took cowboy tunes, such as in Rodeo, and Billy the Kid, Sweet. And so he developed a musical lexicon of what we consider American-sounding music. In the same way that Gershwin, if you will, along with Bernstein, developed an urban-sounding classical music that was tinged with jazz and certain harmonic forms.
So it really has the stamp of that nation's folk music and popular music on it when you say nationalistic music. So this Sibelius has a Norwegian feel that's very deep.
Exactly. Very well said. And, you know, there are numerous examples. Dvorak, Tarina from Spain. It's easy to think of Rimsky-Korsakov, and Tchaikovsky certainly are also prime examples. But even Vaughan Williams used British folk songs in his orchestral writing.
So we're going to hear a selection now from Sibelius's Second Symphony, and it's the last movement. Tell us what we're about to hear and why you chose that particular movement.
I like to imagine standing on a cliff overlooking or looking into the North Sea after a horrific storm has passed. The clouds are parting. This is rather biblical sounding, but the sunbeams are coming down. And just the sense of triumph, the sense of joy, the sense of possibility. That's what this music is about, the sense of possibility and triumph. And he uses the trumpets and brass to great effect, along with the woodwinds and the passionate string sound. It's a wonderful, wonderful piece of music. I'm going to have to ban that word from my vocabulary. I use it so much. It's a terrific piece of music that speaks to any listener, whether they're new to classical music or an old hand.
Well, with that build-up, let's hear it. And that was an excerpt from Sibelius, the Second Symphony. And we're talking to Gregory Heltman of the Santa Fe Symphony and Chorus. Now, you have lectures at 3 o'clock, mm-hmm. which is before each performance of the symphony. What are those about? Are you speaking or who's speaking?
Stephen Smith will come on stage, and for about a half hour, from 3 to 3:30, before the concert, give an overview of what we're going to perform that afternoon, and we invite the audience to join us for those very informative talks. It gives a chance for a few questions from the audience. Oftentimes, there's so many questions that we can't get to everybody, but it also gives a chance for some perspectives on the music that may not just be obvious through reading the program notes.
I think lectures like that can be so valuable because then when you're, particularly for non-musicians who love music, and especially if you've never heard a piece before. It's one thing, I noticed this with the Chamber Music Festival this year. I went to a lot of the concerts, or I mean for me a lot, and I noticed that there was a big difference between the ones where I already knew the piece and the ones that I didn't. And when you don't know a piece of music and you go to the lecture beforehand, usually the lecturer will hum some pieces from it and let you know what to look for, and it makes the music so much richer.
It is an important tool in bringing new audience members into the concert hall, quite frankly. What we have found through the years is that folks have anxiety because they don't know necessarily what to listen for, even how to dress, where to park, and we're trying to let people know that it's not as uptight as it might seem. You want
to
come in. You
want to
come in jeans and you know, just a work shirt. That's fine. We hope that it's a fairly clean work shirt because the seats are fairly close together. But you know, we don't have anybody go through a smellometer for that matter. But
we have not gotten there yet with our surveillance equipment.
Not quite yet. But we have oftentimes we have folks who are moving to Santa Fe, move to Santa Fe, call us for tickets. And say, what do people wear to the symphony? And we say from coat and tie to jeans and a dress t-shirt.
And that's what we love about this city.
Exactly.
Is anything goes within reason. Gregory Heltman is founder and general director of the Santa Fe Symphony and Chorus. They are on the web at santafesymphony.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us. I appreciate it.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm very happy now to welcome to the show Carissa Arrett. She's with Big Brothers Big Sisters of Northern New Mexico. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So Big Brothers Big Sisters is having a big event, which we're going to be talking about in a little while, that is happening on the 1st of October, coming up that Saturday. But for those who have not heard of this organization, or for those who have, what's it all about?
Well, Big Brothers Big Sisters believes that inherent in every child is the ability to thrive and succeed in life. And so Big Brothers Big Sisters of America was started over 100 years ago and has since, there's over 350 agencies throughout the country. And of course, we are in northern New Mexico and we cover Santa Fe, Los Alamos, Taos, Rio Arriba, McKinley, San Miguel, and Mora counties currently. And so basically, the mission is to provide children facing adversity with strong and enduring, professionally supported one-to-one relationships that change their lives for the better forever. So through their mentoring relationships, the littles, who are the children in our program.
Little brothers and little sisters,
and they are matched with big brothers and big sisters. Most of those fall under the two programs. We have the community-based program and the school-based program. And right now we're gearing up for school-based, you know, since it's September, kids are back in school. So that program is where the big and the little meet about an hour a week at the same time, same location on school grounds, and the same day. So, for instance, Tuesdays from 11:30 to 12:30, they meet and they have lunch, or they play in the playground, or they read, they play some basketball. I mean, there's a variety.
So it's not tutoring.
It's not tutoring. Okay. Yeah, and so that is a common misperception. A lot of people do think that we're a tutoring service, and while bigs do help their littles sometimes with homework, or they read, or they take an interest in their school projects, it's more just about the friendship and the relationship that grows between the big and the little, and that positive influence.
What's that like for the other kids who don't have a...
They're very jealous, usually.
Really?
Yes. I've done both the school-based and the community-based program, and when I would go visit my little sister in, she was in sixth grade at the elementary school, all of her little friends would just gather around me, and they'd want to be a part of it. You know, they'd be like, oh, who's this? And she'd be like, oh, this is my big sister. And they just kind of beam. They glow. It's a really fun experience for them.
Yeah.
And Yeah, so you get to hang out with them and,
so
and make
like,
a difference.
It's not like, who's that lady?
No, yeah. You I was a little intimidated when I first went into an elementary school. But no, people are like, oh, that's really cool. You know, and sometimes they think that you're their biological big sister, you know. But, you know, then you explain the program. They're like, oh, I want one. And
right.
So, so yeah, it's a really fun, rewarding program and great for people that are on tight schedules that maybe really just can't give up an evening or weekend to do the community-based program, which I'll talk about in a second. It's very steady, very consistent every week, same time, only about an hour.
I suppose for kids who are challenged, and of course those are the kids who get into that program anyway, challenged by their home lives or whatever reason, you know, what they say is consistency is just a really good thing for kids.
It is, yeah. Consistency is very important. When anyone thinks about mentoring, we do ask that they commit to at least a year.
Yeah.
Just because we know from studies that really makes the biggest impact is when littles are matched with their bigs for at least a year.
Now, when you did this, what was it like for you? What was your little, was it a little sister?
It was little sister, yes. Women can be matched with little boys. We do not match men with little girls. But, you know, if there was a lady out there who was interested in having a little brother, that can be arranged. But I did have a little girl. I'm very girly, so it's kind of, yeah, it made more sense. It was fun. I'd go and I'd have lunch with her. We'd start with lunch, and then we'd go out to the playground, and we'd hang out. And sometimes we'd go back to the classroom, and she'd show me her art project. She was very artistic, so she'd show me that, or she'd show me some of her cheerleading routines. She was in the cheerleading squad. And, we'd just talk and hang out. And it's a lot easier than people think. People sometimes are, I think, kind of nervous. They're like, what am I going to do with this kid? But it's really easy. It just kind of flows and comes
naturally.
And what
grade was she in?
She was in sixth.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think one of the things when I think about doing something like that, I think I wasn't very happy in sixth. Well, actually, sixth grade was pretty good, but like once you get to seventh, eighth grade, it was kind of a nightmare.
It's tough, yeah.
And so you're, on some level, I suppose you're reliving a little bit of that yourself.
Yeah, definitely. You're kind of going back and seeing what it's like from their perspective. And it is a very challenging age, you know, that whole adolescence, puberty thing, and just a lot of questions, a lot of confusion. And so I think having that positive adult role model in their lives can be very helpful.
And so the community-based program is basically you get a little brother, a little sister, and what is it, once a week?
It's really up to the big and the little and the parents' schedule. It's very flexible. We ask for 6 to 8 hours a month,
okay,
minimum. But a lot of times our bigs go over that because they have so much fun and there's so much to do. And our big brothers and big sisters realize that they're getting to get out in the community and do things that they wouldn't ordinarily do.
Right.
Or they're doing stuff that they would normally do, but they're just taking their little brother or little sister along with them. So it really is as big of a time commitment as people think. It goes really fast, you know, and so it's very easy to make that time when you're having a good time and you're seeing the impact and when you enjoy the relationship.
And if you're going to go to the IMAX theater or something, that takes hours to do
exactly.
There and get that, which is nice quality time spent with a kid.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah. Some of our bigs and littles, they prefer to do maybe two outings a month, but they're bigger. You know, maybe they'll go to Albuquerque or they'll do a longer event like an IMAX thing. And some prefer just an hour, hour and a half a week. That's what I did usually in the evenings because of my little schedule. I had, just to clarify, I had a school-based little and a community-based little.
Right.
And with my community-based little, who was in fifth grade at the time, weekends didn't work out for her family due to a custody situation. So we would meet in the evenings, just, you know, maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours after school. We'd bake cookies. We'd go to the park. We'd go to the mall.
She
was very into shopping.
House?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'd go to my house and bake cookies, and or we'd go to the mall. She was very into shopping at almost 12 years of age. So, and it was very rewarding.
And how long were you together, so to speak?
We were together a year, and then she had to move away.
Oh.
So, yeah, it was, sometimes that happens. Life does happen. We do understand that. So, but then that's when I was rematched with my school-based little.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. And did you keep in touch?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's doing very well. She lives in Albuquerque.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, we're talking about Big Brothers, Big Sisters of Northern New Mexico. So, last time we had somebody on, or the time before, there was they were looking for big brothers in particular.
Yes. That is always our need. We do a push in the summer. That it tends to be when we get a lot of little boys enrolled, but we're looking for Big Brothers all year round. We tend to have about 70 little boys in Santa Fe County alone on the waiting list. And it's just because more little boys are referred to the program, and we don't have enough male volunteers coming in. So there's always that need for Big Brothers.
What listeners who are listening right now might want to take note are the qualities in a Big Brother, particularly, or Big Sister, that are necessary to do this and really have fun.
Yeah. The biggest thing I think we just talked about was consistency. You know, making sure it's not that you don't break an Audi. I mean, things happen, life happens, we certainly understand that, but being consistent, showing up when you say you're going to, and being there for them is really a key. But honestly, people think that there's this certain personality type you have to have or qualities that you have to have. We have Big Brothers and Big Sisters from all walks of life, all different kinds of backgrounds and personalities, and they're great. And there's no one key attribute that would make you a better candidate for this than something else. So it's really great, the diversity of personalities, because children are very diverse. So we try to match people based on personalities and interests.
Now, do you match, for example, nerdy adults with nerdy kids?
If it's a request. We have an interest form that both the parents or guardians fill out along with the Big Brothers or Big Sisters, and that's at the beginning of the enrollment process, and then that's how they make the match, is based on interest. So if a child was really interested, say, in science or computers, you know, or geology or something, you know, we would do our best to match them with a big with the similar qualities.
And I suppose it works the other way around, too. I mean, a Big Brother or Big Sister could request a nerdy kid or a sports-oriented kid or whatever.
Yes. Actually, for Big Brothers, that is the biggest request we get from little brothers or potential little brothers, is that they want a sporty, outdoorsy Big Brother. So, yeah, that tends to be a trend, you know, little boys.
All right.
To play basketball and
once again,
soccer.
Gentlemen, take note.
Exactly.
The website which you can find out more information on is bbbsnorthernnm.org, and we'll give more information later on. Big Brothers and Big Sisters has been going on for so long that you've been able to really collect data and follow up. I mean, a lot of these little brothers and little sisters who are 9-year-olds or whatever are adults now.
Yes, yes. We actually do have quite a few alumni that, from the program that come back, and a lot of them will do speaking engagements for us on our behalf and talk about the program and what an impact that has made in their lives. And so it's really fun to see them after they've grown up and to see what they've done, and for them to come back and say, you know, Big Brothers, Big Sisters changed my life. I wouldn't be where I am today without my Big Brother or my Big Sister. That's very, it's very moving. It's very powerful.
And I suppose it keeps them off the streets and out of gangs to some extent, or a large extent.
It does. There's been some national research, and it has shown that positive relationships between littles and their bigs have a direct and measurable impact on the child's life. And by participating in our programs, little brothers and sisters are more confident in their schoolwork performance, able to get along better with their families, 46% less likely to begin using drugs, 27% less likely to begin using alcohol, 33% less likely to hit someone, and 52% less likely to skip school. So there's some pretty positive outcomes from this program, and so we're very proud of those statistics.
We're talking to Carissa Arrett. So Big Brothers, Big Sisters of Northern New Mexico, I mean, you guys do very good fundraising events and are a wonderful and very well-established and well-loved nonprofit in this city. You've got an event coming up on Saturday evening, the 1st of October, at Buffalo Thunder. Is that right?
It's at the Hilton Santa Fe Golf Resort and Spa at Buffalo Thunder at 6 p.m. on Saturday, October 1st.
And so what's going to happen over there?
We are having the Little Gala for a Big Cause. And that is going to feature a hosted cocktail reception and silent auction. And the silent auction has over 200 items, a great shopping experience for anyone who's interested in just getting a good deal, but that also goes to a good cause.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of things. There's anything from the practical to the lavish and everything in between. You know, we've got practical items like mouth guards, teeth cleaning, tires for your car and car service packages, to trips to Italy and France.
Wow.
And then, yeah, and then, of course, everything in between. So that'll be really fun. I've already kind of started to go through and look at all the items. It's really fun as they come in.
And good food.
Absolutely. We've got Chef Carmen Rodriguez, who is our culinary coordinator. He coordinated all this last year, and he's doing it again for us this year. And it is eclectic global cuisine. And it's prepared by some of Santa Fe's top chefs, served family style, and I think it's worth it just for the food. about 10 different chefs from around Santa Fe come together, and they create a dish that speaks to their restaurant's theme, but it's all coordinated by Carmen, who makes sure that the menu goes well together. And some of our participating restaurants are Amavi, Jambo, Pranzo Italian Grill,
nice.
Balconies on the Plaza, Blue Corn Cafe, Saffron of Santa Fe, Delancey Street Catering, Red Sage, and Pueblo of Pewaukee, the chef from Pueblo of Pewaukee. So, yeah, we're very excited about that. And then during the silent auction, we are going to be having music by Savor.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. Who's a
Musica Cubana.
Exactly. And they are loved in this city. I love their music.
Indeed.
And then we also have during dinner John Trinacosta and Straight Up.
KSFR's very own.
Yes. They're wonderful as well. They played last year. And we have a special performance by Otmar Liebert.
Excellent.
Yes. He's a famous composer and guitarist of Luna Negra.
And there's a live auction also.
There is. And our live auction this year is featuring one-of-a-kind artwork from Dan Arlo and Michael Nemingha, created exclusively for Big Brothers and Big Sisters of Northern New Mexico. So you can't get this particular artwork anywhere else but the gala. So
yay.
We're very excited about that. I've seen Michael's piece. It's very, very cool. So
this is all on Saturday night, October 1st.
Yes.
For tickets, people can call 505-983-8360. And they can also go to bbbsnorthernnm.org. And a little plug also for people who, if anybody wants to volunteer to be a school-based mentor, they can also call that same number, 983-8360.
Yes, and you can actually go online and start filling out an inquiry if you are interested in becoming a volunteer, and get a lot more information about our different programs on there.
Carissa Arrett is with Big Brothers Big Sisters. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.